difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
Do you believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome to the Next Picture Show, a movie of the week podcast devoted to a classic film and how it shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Scott Tobias, here with
Keith Phipps
and
Genevieve Kosky.
Here on the Next Picture Show, we believe that no film exists in a vacuum and that all culture is more interesting in context. So every other week, we get together to talk over a classic film and consider how it relates to a current movie. This week, we're hacking our way through miles of untamed South American jungle in search of profound truths in ancient civilizations. Personally, I love the jungle. I think it's full of erotic elements. What do you think, Genevieve?
Well, there is some sort of harmony here, Scott. It is the harmony of overwhelming and collective murder.
Wow. So I guess we'll just have to agree to disagree on that one. But maybe we'll settle our differences over the two jungle adventures in this week's episode. Want to tell us about those?
Oh, sure. The new James Gray film, The Lost City of Z, based on David Grand's best-selling book, tells the story of Percy Fawcett, a turn-of-the-century British explorer who made multiple attempts to find an ancient city in the Amazon. While on a perilous mission to map out a border between Brazil and Bolivia, Fawcett discovers evidence of what he believes was a great lost civilization in the heart of the jungle. His obsessive quest courts danger from the extreme heat, from disease and deadly animals, and from indigenous peoples who are suspicious of outsiders. In order to achieve his elusive goal, Fawcett has to contend with nature first, and his struggles recall director Werner Herzog in Burden of Dreams, Les Blank's documentary about the making of Herzog's Fitzcarraldo. Both men are inspired and a little bit crazy, and their actions say a lot about the vision and hubris of Westerners trying to conquer an untamable territory.
Yes. It's like I was saying, Genevieve, the jungle's great. Especially if you're experiencing it in an air-conditioned theater or in the comfort of your own home, just as I experienced Burden of Dreams and The Lost City of Z. So catch jungle fever with us after the break.
At the age of 37, German filmmaker Werner Herzog has a worldwide reputation as one of the most talented directors to come out of the movement known as the New German Cinema. In 1977, he ventured deep into the upper Amazon jungle of Peru, scouting locations for a surrealistic adventure film he'd been planning for years, Fitzcarraldo. From the beginning, he expected it to be an extremely difficult project, but it wouldn't be the first time he'd risked everything for new images. In 1971, for instance, he came to the upper Amazon to film Aguirre, Wrath of God, and he and his crew spent weeks living on rafts in the middle of the river. Some critics feel that Herzog seeks out physical danger to test himself. Herzog insists he's a professional taking reasonable risks to create images no one has ever seen before. This time, however, the dangers were so extreme that he invited filmmaker Les Blank to shoot a documentary of Fitzcarraldo being made, as if he were afraid that the documentary might be the only record of his epic adventure. Join with Herzog, Klaus Kinski, and 800 Peruvian Indians as they risk their lives and their sanity.
It's hard to say exactly when it happened, but at some point, Werner Herzog, one of the major figures in New German cinema, became Werner Herzog, the pop culture legend. Perhaps it was the time he ate his own shoe after losing a bet with Errol Morris. Or perhaps it was the time he got shot in the middle of an interview and said, "It was not a significant bullet." But whatever the case, the go-to footage of Werner Herzog are those scenes in Les Blank's Burden of Dreams when he talks about the jungle in floridly despairing terms, about the birds and the trees screaming in misery, about how God, if he exists, created the land in anger, about overwhelming misery and overwhelming fornication, overwhelming growth and overwhelming lack of order. Werner Herzog is a fun character that we like to play, and often Werner Herzog is a fun character Werner Herzog likes to play. Yet it's wonderful to see Burden of Dreams in full, just to understand those famous Herzog quotes in context, because they arrive near the end of one of the most notoriously difficult productions in film history. Inspired by a Peruvian rubber baron named Carlos Fitzcarrald, Herzog set out to tell the story of a turn-of-the-century adventurer who longed to build an opera house in the Amazon jungle and bring Caruso to sing. To make this dream happen, Fitzcarraldo has to make a fortune in the rubber business, a plan that involves employing local Indians to drag a huge riverboat over an isthmus separating one riverway from another. The real Fitzcarraldo took the boat apart and carried it over the hill in pieces. Herzog, on the other hand, employed Aguaruna laborers to drag a 320-ton riverboat up a 40-degree incline using a primitive pulley system. Is this inspiration? Is this insanity? Is this exploitation? Les Blank's documentary suggests it's all three. There are so many astonishing moments in Bird and Dreams. My favorite is the engineer of the pulley system predicting a 70% chance of catastrophe and Herzog still opting to press on. But one of the ideas that stays with me is embedded in the title. Herzog believed and still believes that the conditions of a production make an indelible mark on the finished film. Time and time again, Herzog could have made Fitzcarraldo easier on himself, his crew, and his financiers, and he always took the hard route, because it served the Sisyphean vision he was trying to express. He refuses to compromise. He wants to know, as an artist, what it's like to challenge nature at its most forbidding and stubbornly refuse to yield to it. And Blank's camera is there to witness the madness.
Of course we are challenging nature itself, and it hits back. It just hits back, that's all, and that's grandiose about it, and we have to accept that it is much stronger than we are. Kinski always says it's full of erotic elements. I don't see it so much erotic, I see it more full of obscenity. It's just, and nature here is vile and base. I wouldn't see anything erotical here. I would see fornication and asphyxiation and choking and fighting for survival and growing and just rotting away. Of course, there's a lot of misery, but it is the same misery that is all around us. The trees here are in misery, and the birds are in misery. I don't think they sing, they just screech in pain.
So just general thoughts here. What did you think of Burden of Dreams?
I think it's fascinating. I had never seen it before. And as you said in your keynote, it's really interesting to see the legend of Werner Herzog taking shape. And there's so much in this documentary to pick apart. But I'm curious, because this was your suggestion, Scott, mm-hmm. and I am curious your thoughts on it, because as someone who is constantly dismissing extratextual information
yes.
in discussing film,
mm-hmm.
is this not a film that is entirely extratextual?
Well, no. I mean, it's a documentary. So we are talking about Les
Blank's...
But
it's a documentary about a
We're
film.
Talking about Les Blank's vision of how Fitzcarraldo is made. So it's totally fine.
Okay.
I like to know about how movies are made, especially when they're...
When they're insane.
Yeah.
When at every step, it's like, why are you doing it that way?
Yeah.
I don't know. I kind of came away with it wondering if there was some sort of underlying philosophy that the effort he put into it would show in the final product in the film through some sort of maybe mystical force, or if Herzog just doesn't know how to make a movie any other way, just to go out there and do it. I mean, there's not what planning there is, all kind of falls apart, but it almost seems like as distressed as he is by the jungle and as beaten down as he gets, it almost seems like this is kind of business as usual for him. This is just how you make movies.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's like method filmmaking, right? It's like just get into the muck. I happen to, speaking of extratextuals, I watched an interview with Herzog about his experience on Burden of Dreams. And one insight he did have into his process on this was that he never liked to treat landscapes as scenery. Mm. He liked to treat them as sort of like inner landscapes. And that involved like really being in the soup. You know, it's a philosophy of filmmaking that I happen to agree with, which is I do think...
You don't think the same reaction with just Klaus Kinski against a green screen?
Right. Exactly, right, exactly. Like, the conditions of a production do stain it and do give it a certain texture, a quality that you can't achieve in a studio. And so I think there's that. And there's also a thing, I think, an artistic impulse on Herzog's part to put himself experientially through what Fitzcarraldo went through. And I'm reminded a little bit of the movie Hearts of Darkness about the making of Apocalypse Now, which is a very similar case in that you could make an argument that Burden of Dreams and Hearts of Darkness were better versions of the same material than the films that they're about, in a way that they tell essentially the same story, except with the filmmaker in the lead role.
Well, and also we talk about Herzog kind of intending to not quite replicate the experience of the characters in his story, but, you know, honor it by going through it himself in the filmmaking process. But there's a huge added layer to that in the actual making of a film, because, like, and we see it again and again in Burden of Dreams, like, he's not just wrangling natives for one shot. He's doing it over and over and over again. And there's a, you know, something's off here. They're trying to capture magic hour. And there's just this added level of difficulty in making a film and all of the added moving parts that come with that, that go beyond just whatever, you know, heady philosophical, whatever you want to put on this experience.
Yeah.
And well, I think that, not to get extra textual, but I did mm-hmm. read that Blank was very frustrated during the making of this film, yeah. and he kind of hated it. And like through that lens, I totally understand why, because it's like, you're making a film here. Like, you're not going through this experience. You're making something, and there's steps that need to be taken. And it just, I can see it being very, very frustrating from the perspective of another filmmaker to watch a filmmaker go through this.
Or the financier.
Which one?
Or the actors, or the, yeah. or the crew members, or the indigenous peoples. Yeah. I mean, it is, everyone is put through the ringer in this thing. And it's right there in the title, Burden of Dreams. But I tell you, I was really touched by Herzog's quote. You know, I guess it's toward the beginning of the film when things first went awry with Jason Robards coming down with some horrible illness, and then Mick Jagger dropping out, and production costs mounting, and no real clear way forward. And, you know, he's asked if he wants to leave the project, and
I think I know the quote you're about to cite. Can I guess?
Yeah.
Is it, if I abandoned this project, I would be a man without dreams?
That's right. If I would be a man without dreams. I mean, that's a remarkable quote. I mean, that commitment to it. And you sense that as much as he bleep talks the jungle, that there are some shots of him in action that are just so exciting and adventurous. I mean, you've mm-hmm. got him, you know, playing soccer with the natives. And there's another shot of him, one of my favorite shots in the movie, where he's on top of one of the steamships as it's veering off into, like, you know, the woods,
a
bank, and he's smoking a cigarette, and he's like dodging all these branches that are coming toward him as the riverbank is destroying his ship. But it's just like, he's in the mix, and that's just, it feels like that is the type of film that he wants to make. And if you look at his work overall, you know, he's gone to some pretty crazy lengths to get movies made. I mean, he had a movie called Heart of Glass where he hypnotized the whole cast.
Yeah, I mean, as contradictory as it sounds, it kind of being out of his element is Herzog in his element, because, I mean, this is not his first trip to the jungle. He's done Aguirre before this, which mm-hmm. we talked about
yeah.
in an earlier episode. Even Dwarfs Started Small does not look like a pleasant shoot. It's like some sort of strange island he went to for that. I mean,
yeah.
And he's still doing it. His movie, what was it last year, Into the Inferno, that he like went to North Korea
sure.
and, you know, into volcanoes and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, he encounters the end of the world. He was traipsing about Antarctica.
He went to New Orleans. Oh, that's fine. I like New Orleans.
Yeah, you know, he likes to be in the mix. And I do. I honestly do think it shows, but I still, I mean, it's been a while since I've seen Fitzcarraldo, and I do admire it, and it is full of beauty and majesty and all the things that he, I think, is trying to capture, all the things you see him trying to capture in Burden of Dreams. But I think Burden of Dreams is the pure expression of the essence of the material than the finished product.
I can't put one over the other because I like them both so much. I'll take the wishy-washy person. I love that there are these companion pieces. I love that you can watch one and then the other and see them reflect off of each other in some really interesting ways. And yeah.
Yeah, I mean, again, that's still, I guess, also the Hearts of Darkness, Apocalypse Now dynamic, sure. too. But it is fascinating.
Although I think this is a better film than Hearts of Darkness, which I like. But you can put these on a shelf as bookends, whereas I feel like Hearts of Darkness is a really good DVD supplement, I guess, to Apocalypse Now.
That's a little... I'm not going to go that. You've gone too far, Keith.
Okay,
but I will say, I mean, Les Blank, there's a level of artistry
yes.
in the documentary, in the filmmaking here, that's not quite present in Hearts of Darkness, but is more so.
Mm.
It's more like Man of La Mancha would be more of like what you're saying Hearts of Darkness is like, right?
You mean Lost in La Mancha.
Lost in La Mancha.
I can break into the impossible dream at any moment if you want me to.
Oh, boy. You know, Lost in La Mancha. Boy, howdy. So, as I said in the intro, Herzog's monologues near the end of the film are a big part of his legend as a public figure. What did you think of them in context?
I mean, they make a lot more sense in context. I don't want to say like they're inherently nonsensical, but like, as you said, it's like at the end of, God, almost like 4 years, I think, at this point, or at least 3 solid years of trying to get this made. And like, he's at the end of his rope. Mm-hmm. Like, it's completely understandable for him to talk the way he does. And the fact that he does it so floridly and poetically is what makes that character of Werner Herzog so easy to latch onto. But the actual emotions behind it, I think, are completely understandable from what we've seen him go through.
And again, I keep digging in extra textual things. I mean, those monologues were things that Les Blank had picked up on earlier and that Herzog performed in a way.
Oh.
So this is him.
Well, then I take it all back.
Playing the character of Werner Herzog.
And it doesn't always come through in this film for obvious reasons. And I'm not an expert because there's a lot of films. I've only seen a couple of other movies, but Les Blank's a very playful filmmaker. And this doesn't necessarily lend itself to that kind of playfulness, but it does have moments like that. And the sort of terrifying moment where you think someone has died as well.
Oh my gosh.
It's kind of a horrible prank. You know, I've seen this movie before, but I'd forgotten that too. And the movie builds up to the point where it creates a sense of unsafe conditions that it's completely plausible that someone's going to die on set.
Yeah. Yeah, fact, 70% chance.
It's a bizarre that no one did die.
Right.
Yeah, like to the point where at the very end when they're showing all the Polaroids, all the photographs that have been taken, like for a brief moment until I actually like went through in my head and remember that, okay, they would have said something if someone had actually died. I thought those were like people that had died during the making of this film that they were memorializing because, I don't know, I guess we're just in an age now where I see black and white photos and I think dead. But like it's kind of amazing that no one did die.
Yeah, it was like a strange resurrection, though, that shot of one of the workers just being just totally submerged in mud. You think he's just been flattened.
Yeah.
And then he goes in the water.
His blood on, and turns out to be makeup blood. But, yeah.
And he goes in the water and it all just kind of dissipates. But there's another element to it, too. And this is on Les Blank and his priorities as a filmmaker, which is that, you know, Herzog, the system that he was given that was going to be 70% chance catastrophe was not the system that was used after that guy left. They installed a much more stable and powerful pulley system than the one we see in the movie. It just serves the movie's purpose to make it seem more dangerous than it was and to make Herzog seem more reckless than he was, which makes me kind of surprised that Herzog would concede to continuing to work with Les Blank and having, you know, I don't know. And so there's all these levels of filmmakers with their own agendas and, you know, kind of a fudging of the truth or a massaging of the truth to tell different types of different stories. You know, that's the story Les Blank wants to tell and the story Herzog wants to tell, and they're not necessarily the same story.
It's not only my dreams. My belief is that all these dreams are yours as well. And the only distinction between me and you is that I can articulate them. And that is what poetry or painting or literature or filmmaking is all about. It's as simple as that. And I make films because I have not learned anything else. And I know I can do it to a certain degree. And it is my duty, because this might be the inner chronicle of what we are. And we have to articulate ourselves, otherwise we would be cows in the field.
Well, I guess it will play a little bit more once we bring in Lost City of Z, but I am fascinated by how those quotes reveal Herzog's perspective on nature and how it operates and how human beings might relate to it or work their way through it. I mean, because that's sort of the major contrast between these two films. But I guess we'll get to that in a little bit. But it is interesting to see him talking about nature as being chaos and murder and not harmonious, but a place of just overgrowth.
Don't forget misery.
Misery. The trees are in misery. Yes. The birds are in misery. You know, it's a fascinating point of view.
I mean, he's not wrong.
No.
You know, and I think that is a... And I say this as someone who avoids nature whenever possible, but I think it's much easier to romanticize nature when you haven't spent a lot of time in it against your will. Mm-hmm. And I think as someone who has spent a lot of time in a very trying part of nature, I think it seems like Herzog probably kind of already had this view of nature, but like this experience had to have calcified that for him or intensified it. But for like, sure. Dude, nature sucks.
keep in mind, I mean, he is approaching it with eyes wide open and with, I think, more a much richer understanding of it than, you know, the characters in A Gear of the Wrath of God. I mean, he's not wearing heavy armor. He's a guy who likes to be out there and getting into the mix. And we see him having, I mean, he is in his element in a way, but that element is still, you know, extraordinarily hostile in this case, and especially over the burden of however many years it took to get this thing finished.
That brings up something that I kind of wanted to talk about, which the film spent a little bit of time on, but not too much, which is the differences in the camps between the indigenous people and the filmmaking crew. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I really like that Blank kind of engages with the fact that there are two different kind of standards of living within this already rough environment. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think Herzog's defense of it is very interesting. I don't know to what extent I buy it, but yeah. I'm curious what you guys think of that.
I mean, I think it's troubling.
Yeah.
I mean, their justification is that while they're paying a pittance to the locals, they're making twice as much as they would under other circumstances. But that twice as much is not nearly what anybody else on the film crew is making. So they are able to exploit, you know, dozens upon dozens of laborers at a very reasonable cost, I would say, in under very dangerous conditions to make this movie. And so I think that's definitely troubling and something that the film itself finds troubling too. I mean, if you think about Burden of Dreams, the burden is not just on Herzog. It's also on people who don't have as much control over it, who are being exploited.
You know, Herzog will go on about how these are the last real Indians we'll ever see or something like that. But holding that point of view, it's kind of hard to justify bringing a film crew into this environment at all. I mean, he seems concerned about the end of a certain way of life. I know he's, you know, sincere about it, but, and I certainly wouldn't want Fitzcarraldo to just disappear off the face of the earth, but it is, you know, to use the word of the times, it's certainly a problematic situation to make any sort of movie in this environment. And even if they're paying the locals a king's ransom, it's still disrupting this situation that's already very much endangered.
And they're not treading lightly by any stretch. I mean, they're cutting out a swath in the on this hill or this mountain to drag this ship over, and so that's disrupting the landscape. I mean, it's a gear-esque.
Yeah, and here's my question. I probably should have researched this before, but instead I'm just going to ask you guys and hope that maybe you know the answer. Is that one of Herzog's justifications for it is that, like, he struck a deal with the indigenous people to, like, basically give them the rights to the land when the filming was done. Do we know if that happened?
No.
Okay. Tasha, this is why we need Tasha here, because I'm sure she would have, like, three different sources, too.
Wait, well, hold on. Tasha's not here?
Oh, yeah.
We haven't acknowledged that.
She's lost in the jungle somewhere. The jungle of New York.
Let me look that up real quick, because I think there might be an answer to that question.
Well, after a research break, we don't seem to have an answer to that question.
But maybe one of our intrepid listeners.
Maybe so. And maybe this is a fault of Les Blanks, because there is some information in the film itself about Herzog and the production's sort of insertions in various tribal conflicts, but I'm not really clear about what those were and how those were resolved or not resolved.
Yeah, I had a similar confusion regarding the various tribal politics, because there's almost like two phases of this production. Basically, like he pissed off the Aguaruna Indians, and they like burned down the set.
That was in 1979.
Yeah, 1979. Mm-hmm. They burned down the camp, so they had to go upriver somewhere and establish a new camp.
The changes in facial hair can kind of tell you, you know, where you are in time in this film too, which tends to leap back and forth fairly liberally.
Yeah, that's true. So yes, that is definitely probably a source of the confusion. Also just kind of dealing with a culture and political system that is very different from our own, that we are not familiar with and is at this point in time not particularly well codified. I think like we're kind of dropped in at the beginning and the middle of a border war between Peru and Ecuador, which we're not given the resolution to at all. And, you know, I'm not super up on my South American history, so I don't know. But I guess there's just a lot of questions in this film kind of circling around the tribal politics that and no satisfying answers, because that's obviously not what Blank is setting out to do. But it is interesting that it is so integral to what's happening and yet so backgrounded in the narrative of this film, I think.
That's true. And I mean, I think it's maybe also true of Apocalypse Now as well, which is another troubled production where I think the perspective of the filmmakers in both cases was, we're just going to drop ourselves into this chaos where we don't really have all the information we need to help guide the production through it in a more seamless fashion. And whatever happens, we'll just deal with as the film goes on. I mean, there's something kind of just deliberately, recklessly spontaneous about the making of this film that almost obliterates any other like rational or moral or practical concerns.
I mean, I think you can still have those concerns and, you know, admire the audacity.
Oh, no, without question.
I'm
not going to paint over any of it. No, I didn't mean to suggest that. I was just trying to say, you know, there is a recklessness in the making of this film.
Sure.
So we're, of course, talking a lot about the making of Fitzcarraldo, which is the subject of this film. But Burden of Dreams itself is a piece of documentary filmmaker, and Les Blank is a significant practitioner of the craft. So what did you think of Burden of Dreams as a piece of documentary filmmaking? And you know, what Les Blank touches stand out for you?
Besides all the Garlic Is As Good As 10 Mothers t-shirts on set, yeah. there were at least two that I saw.
I did too. That was a good eye.
Not being very familiar with Les Blank at all, that was a Les Blank touch that stood out.
It's a subtle auteurist stamp.
Yeah. I kind of wonder if it was the crew tweaking him in a way, or if it was
a lot of free t-shirts.
I think they
That's true.
I think they all packed lightly, too lightly. We're reusing the same shirt.
I like the idea of Blank just showing up with a crate of t-shirts of it from his last movie.
You can help date that those scenes though, because that movie came out in 1980, so they probably have to be taking place around or shortly after that. Not before.
Now I wonder if someone on the internet has pieced together Burden of Dreams more chronologically.
Well, that's just it. That's what I was going to say. As a piece of this happened, then this happened, then this happened, documentary filmmaking, it's not very effective. No. But boy, did I leave this film feeling like I had understood what it was like to be on the set of mm-hmm. Fitzcarraldo and what it's like to be around Werner Herzog and the different situations they faced and sort of, if not all the ins and outs of local people's, a better sense of what their experience was watching this happen and how they were exploited a little bit while making this film
a little bit
as a impressionistic, not even impressionistic, but as a captured experience of what this film was and the people behind it and the passions that drove it and the perils behind it, it's pretty peerless.
For everything that has been said about the sort of confusion in this film about the various tribal politics, I do admire that Blank kind of takes some time to highlight and engage with the culture of these indigenous peoples. We get that kind of extended sequence on the Masako and how that kind of informs stuff that's going on in the gringo camp. The detail of like Klaus Kinski not wanting to drink because it's fermented with human saliva and he like replaced it with milk. It was just like, oh, be more of a jerk, Klaus, but also just that like
being said, I don't know.
I mean, if you're going to like,
if you're there.
Yeah, exactly. Like go for the full experience, man.
Like, would that be the worst thing that Klaus Kinski has ever had to do?
Right.
I mean, like, he's both done and perpetuated plenty of crazy stuff.
Yeah. But, and then there's also like that interesting scene with the two sisters arguing over the husband and just kind of like seeing that everyday drama play out and like within this much bigger drama that Herzog is orchestrating, like just seeing those little small personal human stories going on within there is, I think, a really interesting touch and kind of adds to that, not quite you are there, but you're getting kind of a sense of the full picture by just like seeing little bits of that picture.
Yeah, they're just observational details.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would push back slightly against what Keith was saying, despite my confusion a little bit over some of the tribal politics and a lot of matters having to do with that. I think that the narration is quite good, and it does string together the footage it needs to string together and gives us the information that we need.
The narration is crucial, I think.
Oh yeah, it's crucial, and it's another mark.
Kind of a compromise, like it's tacked on, and there's as little of it as you need, but you definitely need it.
No, it's pretty ever present, I think, and it's a thing. We talked about it with the War Room too, in the sense, which didn't have narration, but in both cases, I mean, you're shooting on 16mm, you're doing it for a really long time. You can only shoot so much footage. So you're going to have some gaps, and those gaps do need to be filled in by the narration, which works. And the rest is, as you say, a nice collection of observational details, and that's kind of where the art of documentary filmmaking comes in, of just Les Blank finding not just the story, not just Herzog and his struggles in making this film, but also all of these elements on the edge of the story, on the edge of the set, giving you an impression of what it's like really for the natives to be sequestered for a long time away from their homes and families and away from women for some of them. And it's just, it gives you an impression of how hard it is for them and how much stress it puts on the production, psychologically. So that's all there in the filmmaking. And then it's just a pleasure to see, as I've said, like before, Herzog in his element, Herzog at play, thigh deep in mud, and him playing soccer, and him on top of the steamboat, as it careens downriver, them filming on the ship as it crashes, and there are injuries, and them having to treat the injuries, and it's just like, it's so wonderful just to be a part of that filmmaking experience, because this is one of the most notoriously troubled productions. And I think it would be that if we did not have a camera there to, you know, make history and make history that artfully. So this is just kind of a very, maybe the model making of film, right? Is there any making of film that is more revered than Bernard of Dreams?
Nothing comes to mind. I also kind of wondered, like, how it happened. I mean, I know Herzog and Blank were friends and ran in the same circles, but to allow another film crew onto your already troubled set, it's mm-hmm. It's
Herzog not, was never not, anybody to run away from.
That's true, but tension. It's not something a lot of filmmakers would have encouraged.
He clearly appreciated Les Blank's freedom to make the film he was going to make, because mm-hmm. This isn't the most flattering possible portrait.
Well, I mean, can we acknowledge it? Like, on some level, Herzog is enjoying this. The misery, like the scene you talk about with the steamboat crash, you know, mm-hmm. with him and Klaus Kinski, and they're just like yelling at each other, yeah. and like talking about what happened, and like they're upset, but there's also kind of like an almost, I call it a mania, yeah. to the way they're acting. Like, they're energized, they're charged up by this, and I think there's definitely an element of that to Herzog as a person, and certainly in mm-hmm. this film. And I think that probably informs his willingness to have this documented.
This was movie 4 of 5 that Herzog did with Kinski.
Yeah.
So he was used to working with...
Because they liked each other so much, right?
Right. Yeah, right, exactly. You know, and there was a documentary that Herzog made later called My Best Fiend that was about his working relationship with Kinski and how stormy it was. So he knew what it was. And I think Burden of Dreams, from what I understand about it, Les Blank really is just at the tip of the iceberg in terms of how terrible Kinski was on that mm-hmm. set.
Yeah.
Kinski was a primary source of aggrievement for everyone involved.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that
he's
even
pretty
comes
marginal up in the film.
Right, he is marginal. Yeah. He has a couple of moments where he seems irritable, but there's not... I think there's a whole nother level of things going on that just didn't make the cut, but I think it's...
I sort of like the... Well, my original vision for this film fell apart because Jason Robards got ill and Mick Jagger dropped out. I'll bring in Kinski.
Yeah, yeah. He said in this supplementary feature I watched later that he was thinking of casting himself in the lead role. He thought he would do an adequate job. And a good enough job doing it. He would be credible enough to play the role himself. And he's actually been credible as an actor. I mean, if you look at him in Julian Donkey Boy, for example, the
Jack Reacher.
Yeah, no,
it's pronounced Jack Reacher.
Jack Reacher.
He was really funny on Parks and Recreation.
Sure.
Yeah. No, he knows, and that's fully than Werner Herzog in quotation marks.
No, the full version of that is when he's in Voice in Penguins of Madagascar playing, if I recall correctly, a Werner Herzog like documentarian.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. So I think there are layers to this thing. And I think his whole career has, you know, borne out this idea of filmmaker as adventure, and I think it's an image that he enjoys having. You know, he wants to kind of go out on that limb. I think he feels like that is artistically a valid and important thing to do, and that, you know, sitting in a studio making a movie, that's just not his style. I mean you hear stories that Rescue Dawn was another production of his that was just like people were starving on that set.
Really, that's interesting, because you think after a certain point you have enough studio system protections to prevent that from happening, but perhaps not.
No, that was another one that people went through.
We almost lost Zahn.
Almost lost Zahn. Vale and Zahn. It was a tough shoot. So he's been doing this for a while. So I'm curious. I mean, we don't get a huge glimpse of it, but did seeing the footage of Jason Robards and Mick Jagger make you want to see that version of Fitzcarraldo just a little bit?
I think so. I think I wouldn't mind a peek into the alternate universe where that film got made. I mean, Robards, there are a few finer actors than Jason Robards.
Yeah, I know. Sure. That's
he's
the thing.
So good. He'd be so good. But, you know, apart from performance, Mick Jagger does not have the best track record. And presumably this would be a better vehicle for him and than, you know, Free Jack or something like that. Yeah. But it's definitely intriguing.
There's no way Mick Jagger would have stuck around for 3 years in the jungle to make this movie. It's kind of a non-starter of a thought experiment, because there's like no way it could possibly happen.
I got this tattoo like, you to put out.
You know, I'm one of the biggest rock stars in the world.
Well, I guess I'll go play soccer with the indigenous people a little more.
That would be something.
Yeah. I mean, I'm like not a Fitzcarraldo super fan, so I can't really claim to be super curious about that version of it. But, you know, the footage we see, I mean, Jagger's performance is
committed?
Yeah. I mean, he's working on the tonal plane, I would expect, for this movie.
Yeah, and Herzog's like, nobody else could play this part. I'm just going to eliminate from the screenplay.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
It's over for me. It has to be Jagger. If it's not Jagger, then we're not going to cast that role.
Yeah, he says it was the biggest loss I've had in my career as someone who makes films, was Jagger leaving.
But it's wild to think, like, but I can make the same movie without that role entirely. Yeah. It was so important to the film. Though I do fantasize a little bit about Robards as Fitzcarraldo, because Robards is so good just as an actor generally. I mean, we only get just a tiny glimpse of him here, but, you know, I have a certain amount of affection for Klaus Kinski and the very singular thing that he does, but, I mean, Jason Robards is an actor. So I do kind of wish he had not come down with some horrible life-threatening illness.
It was dysentery, which is pretty bad.
You don't really get a mild case of dysentery,
yeah,
do you?
A mild case of dysentery, that seems like a good place to wrap things up, just as it was for Jason Robards. So we'll be right back with some listener feedback on our last episode. Our last episode on The Matrix and Ghost in the Shell brought a couple of responses on The Matrix and a voicemail on Ghost in the Shell, which was a nice reminder for me that Ghost in the Shell is a thing that exists. So let's start with the emails first. Christopher from Lexington, Kentucky, home of the Residence Inn my family and I stayed at one night, wrote a long email about The Matrix, cyberpunk, and body horror. Keith, do you want to read an excerpt for us?
Sure. Christopher writes, "So I watched The Matrix again the other night after not having seen it in quite some time. And I, like you, found it on the whole just as exciting and fun as when it first came out. I still found the special effects really cool on the whole. The only exception really were those totally CG shots, which do seem to show age. I think this is one of those films like Jurassic Park that took such care with its effects because they were so new at the time that they remained strong, even as copycats try to do the same thing. The only issue I really have with The Matrix, and it was the same when I first saw it, are the attempts at profundity that it strives for from time to time. This is especially true in the long speeches or philosophical gobbledygook Lawrence Fishburne runs through. And if I cannot be intrigued or interested in what Fishburne is saying, then there really is a real problem there. I think the issue here is one of over-explaining. That is, the philosophical considerations about the nature of reality and what makes us human, etc., are in the film already. They are built into the very concept that the film is based on. Therefore, when Fishburne does go on and on about it, in a way that does not really make that much sense a lot of the time, it seems that either A, the directors do not trust the audience to be able to recognize what they are doing, or B, they want to appear to be more deep or profound than the film can actually bear. Either way, it is the only thing that does not really work in the film for me."
Yeah. Well, I mean, he's describing to me the sequels. Really.
Yeah, I get it. I mean, I get where he's coming from. I think I would resist that kind of here's what we're doing explanations in many films. I don't in this one, and I don't really know why. Maybe I think that it's laid out in such a cool way. I mean, it shows and tells at the same time. It's not just an information dump. And I think the concepts, I kind of, you know, I won't speak to the profundity of the insights here, but I think they do walk you up to these really interesting philosophical concepts that that play out in the movie. And I'm not sure it would be, I think it would be a little more muddied if they didn't. So in theory, I'm agreeing with everything he's saying, but in practice, I think it works in this movie. I don't know about you guys.
Yeah, it doesn't really bother me either. And I say that as someone who listened to a lot of clips of Morpheus pulling clips for that episode. But I think it works with Morpheus's characterization, which is kind of like a sensei figure, I guess, to maybe pull from one of the genres influencing the Matrix. And just like he is Neo's guide through this kind of mind expansion, you know, and he's telling these things to Neo, and by extension, of course, he is telling them to us as well. But I think if what Morpheus is trying to do is to get Neo to free his mind, in his own words, like, it makes sense that he would want to unpack the philosophical meaning behind what he is having Neo do, what he is asking Neo to do. Yeah, it doesn't really bother me. I certainly see it. Like, I certainly see that if it is something that bothers you, that it would stick out. But I think Fishburne's performance does a lot to bring it across, and just kind of the tone of the movie. So, you know, I respect your position, Christopher, but I don't fully agree with it, I'm afraid.
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, that it's much more apropos of the sequels, which were guilty of just sitting you down mm-hmm. for a while and you know, in front of a bunch of monitors and telling you what the
You're really movie. Hung up on that monitor shot.
I know. Well, I think it's like it's so the central moment in that movie. I should add also that we promised you an email that was going to get into cyberpunk and body horror.
Yeah.
Did not deliver, so Christopher's full email will be on the Facebook site. He actually mentioned Existenz before listening to Keith recommended in the second part of the episode. So prescient.
Christopher had a lot to say about The Matrix, which we love.
Yes,
and we will definitely post all of it on Facebook.
I should say also that friend of the podcast, Clint Worthington, pointed out that in the list of similar films around the same time, we forgot to mention Dark City, which came out a year before. My head was stuck in 1999.
That was the year before.
But it's another good companion piece to this one, too. Clint is co-host of the Alcohol Hollywood podcast, which I've been on it. And
So back when the Wachowskis made The Matrix, they were billed as the Wachowski brothers, Larry and Andy. They have since come out as trans women, Lana and Lily Wachowski. We talked a lot on the episode about the fluidity of identity that's run throughout their work before and after their transition. And listener Kevin wanted to share his own eureka moment with The Matrix. Genevieve?
Kevin writes, I just wanted to share a realization I had rewatching The Matrix for the first time, knowing it was made by two trans women. One thing that stood out to me was the use of names in the film. It's made clear that Neo, Trinity, Morpheus, et al. Are not the birth names of these characters, but rather new names they took on either as hacker personas in The Matrix or new names they chose as free people. Birth names go unmentioned throughout the rest of the film, save for one recurring example. Mr. Smith insists on referring to Neo as Mr. Anderson, primarily as a signifier of his literal-mindedness, but it also serves as a demeaning insult. It's easy to see parallels with the trans experience of choosing a new name once you come out, establishing your correct gender identity and the struggle coping with the use of your dead name, which can be really hurtful. It's little details that are richer in hindsight, and I was really fascinated realizing that. Thanks for reading my letter. Love your show. I love that insight.
No, me too.
And I mean, I always just took those names, Neo, Trinity, and Morpheus, as a nod to the hacker element, mm-hmm. and hackers always use aliases. And I don't think we could say it was intended in that way, given where the Wachowski siblings were in their mm-hmm. experience at that point. But it is fascinating to think about it in hindsight.
Yeah, I mean, these are the sorts of things that filmmakers may, again, not put there intentionally, but which are part of
the texture of the film.
It's I think we can look back on not just The Matrix, but also The Bound and a lot of other things that they made pre-transition and see a lot of these themes emerge. So that was a good email. Finally, we have this voicemail from Bob.
Voicemail.
Yeah, who offers some insight into the empty shell that is Ghost in the Shell.
Hello, Next Picture Show. This is Bob, and I'm calling about Ghost in the Shell. You guys are so right that it has a great look, but that without a real heart, the visual work is wasted. The opening scene and the stuff immediately after it is amazing, but it doesn't build towards anything. So when you get a misstep like the spider tank, which, by the way, looks like something that would get stepped on in a Godzilla sequel, then there's nothing to fall back on. Your mention of the original Singularity ending points up to me that the movie should have gone more into the Major's head, because that's where the real battle is, and the perfect opportunity to do that was the deep dive sequence. The Geisha Bot is everything the Major doesn't want to be. She's programmed to degrade herself while the Major is so dignified, and she murdered the people she was supposed to serve while the Major protects people. Having their minds merged should have been this incredible, complex, revelatory, existential experience, which maybe it was on a visual level, but I mean on a plot level, but what we see looks like the cutscene you'd get after losing a zombie video game. And from that point on, it seems like the film steadily loses its individuality and sleepwalks into something halfway between Aeon Flux and Underworld, but maybe even less memorable than either of them. When the Major jumps off the building at the end, it feels like a tedious, pointless repetition of something that was once cool, which is kind of the whole film in a nutshell. A ghost nutshell.
Well, thank you for ending on that pun, Bob. We really appreciate it. I listening to that voicemail, I was like, oh yeah, the Geisha Bot, which God, now that it's been a couple of weeks, I remember even less about that movie, but I do think that's a kind of an interesting solve for one of this movie's many, many problems.
Oh yeah, the Geisha Bot. Yeah, it's fun to listen to that voicemail again, just to be reminded that Ghost in the Shell is a movie that I saw once. And I think he's
right. I remember Geisha Bot. Geisha Bot was pretty cool.
Definitely. Yeah. It looked cool, but he's talking about like the deep dive sequence, which, you know, as he said, and I think as we said about most of the film, like looked really cool and was like cool conceptually, but didn't really mirror the narrative in any interesting way.
And in citing films like Aeon Flux and Underworld, I think puts the film pretty close to its proper level in the sense that it does look cool, but it feels, you know, like a videotape that's been recorded over 3 or 4 times. It's very worn out and not fresh and not anything that really sticks to the ribs at all. And I think that speaks to the absence of real substantive ideas in the movie.
I hope we keep getting Ghost in the Shell feedback every week just to keep reminding us that it existed.
Yeah, that's right.
Ghost in the podcast.
As always, we appreciate when our listeners share their thoughts and their recommendations. To reach us, you can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. We may feature your response on a future episode or post it on Facebook for discussion. And that wraps up this episode of the Next Picture Show. In part 2, we'll bring in the Lost City of Z and compare and contrast how the adventurers in both films make their way through nature. Look for that later this week, or better yet, subscribe to the Next Picture Show on Apple Podcasts or your podcatcher of choice. Follow us at facebook.com/nextpictureshow and follow us on Twitter at nextpicturepod so you'll always know when a new episode drops. Until then, we'll be using a primitive pulley system to drag ourselves out of our chairs.